Hey, scaredy cats. Once I got into horror, there was one movie that I purposely avoided watching because the sheer idea of it scared me. Once I finally got up the nerve to watch it, I was terrified, but also hooked. That movie, The Exorcist. The first horror film to be nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture. It was nominated for 9 other Academy Awards, eventually only winning Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Sound. It is one of those movies that is rumored to be cursed, and when it was released in theaters, there were reports of heart attacks and miscarriages in the aisles. On top of all of that, evangelist Billy Graham claimed a real demon lived in the celluloid reels of the movie. It's a beautiful day for an exorcism, so join us as we fight the forces of evil.
Somewhere between science and superstition, there is another world. The world of darkness. Nobody expected it. Nobody believed it. And nothing could stop it.
There are no experts. You probably know as much about possession as most priests. Look, your daughter doesn't say she's a demon. She says she's the devil himself.
I'm telling you that that thing upstairs isn't my daughter. Now, I want you to tell me that you know for a fact that there's nothing wrong with my daughter except in her mind. Don't tell me you know for a fact that an exorcism wouldn't do any good. You tell me that!
The one hope, the only hope, The Exorcist.
Joining us for this episode are some devilishly good guests. From the podcast I Hate Your Taste in Movies, avowed non-horror fan Austin LaMarche. Hi, Austin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to talk about this movie. I have a very big love-hate relationship with it, stemming from some childhood trauma.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And our next guest, Brian Kuiper, is a regular contributor to Bloody Disgusting, Manor Vellum, and Council of Zoom, and is co-host of the Movies for Life podcast. Hey, Brian, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
I'm very excited to be here. I have just pretty much a love relationship with this movie, I think. So I'm excited to talk about it and jump in.
Awesome. So why don't you each tell us a little bit about your podcasts, about you, and then we'll get into the Scaredy Cat 5.
Sure. I can start. My name's Austin. I live in Toronto, and I do education outreach for a musical instrument manufacturing company. And I also co-host a podcast, as you mentioned, called I Hate Your Taste in Movies, where me and two of my friends, who we all have very different tastes in movies, polar opposite tastes in movies, and we make each other watch our favorites and put our friendships on the line every week.
I love it. What's been the most controversial movie that you've done?
Ooh, I think True Lies may have been the most controversial, just in the sense that it has not aged nearly as well as our host Jackie would have hoped it did. So that was a rough conversation.
Fair enough.
Okay, and I'm a co-host of the Movies for Life podcast with Michelle Egan. And each week, we each bring a movie to the table that we love or has a special meaning for us and discuss it. And so we have kind of a double feature a week or every other week now. And we've had some surprising pairings that have come up that we haven't necessarily planned. But when I think my favorite was probably Singing in the Rain and One Cut of the Dead. Just the joy of making movies, the movies about making movies, was the category, and that's what we ended up going with. And that just ended up being kind of the perfect pairing, strangely enough. So we're really enjoying doing that show. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, let's get into the Scaredy Cat 5. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions that we ask every new guest host that comes on the show, just to kind of see what you like in horror, what you don't like in horror. Austin, this might be a little interesting for you because you're not a horror fan, but answer them the best you can.
Sure.
So what is your favorite subgenre of horror?
So, okay, I think I need to preface this with, it's not that I don't like horror. I do like horror. I want to like horror. My body just rejects horror. I'm a scaredy cat. I have a hard time sitting through horror movies, but when I get through them, I usually really like them. So I'm working on it. And I know my co-host Jen's been a guest on your show a few times, and she's working hard to make me a horror fan. So, but I think my favorite is, like, I like paranormal, like, ghosty type movies. I think those scare me the most. So I think for me, they're the most effective. I don't know if it's because I feel like they're in my brain the most realistic or what. I don't know. But those get me every time.
I would have to say for mine, it's probably appropriately enough religious horror. I love horror movies about cults and demons and exorcisms and all sorts of things like that. So maybe because of The Exorcist, I'm not really entirely sure why, but yeah, that's what I go with.
Nice. I would say those two are my favorites. I like anything like possession, religious kind of themed, and any like paranormal, ghosty kind of horror movies, I think, are generally my favorites. But what about least favorite?
For me, I think it's zombie movies. I don't love the gore that's usually associated with them. And I'm sure a lot of people will hate me for saying this, but I feel like they're too predictable and repetitive for me. And I know that every genre has its stereotypes, but I just feel like it bothers me with zombie movies more than in others.
Now, is there a zombie movie that you actually like?
Okay, well, I am the musical person on our I Hate Your Taste in Movies, so I gotta say Anna and the Apocalypse.
Yes. My least favorite. Okay. My least favorite, I thought about this, and I think it's probably like rape revenge movies. Mm. I just have a tough time with them. I know that there can be really cathartic for some people, and I don't want to diminish that. But for me, I just really struggle with them.
Fair. That's fair. I find them very difficult to watch. There are some that I just can't. I can't do.
I wrote an article and I had to watch Last House on the Left, you know, 3 or 4 times. And that was just, I'm done. I'm good for a while, you know.
Yeah. You've got your fill. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite horror movie?
I think it's a classic. I'm going to say Scream. I think it's the one that I've rewatched the most. I love the kind of balance of scary and funny, and it's just smart. I mean, it's a classic. I think it's aged well. It's definitely the one I've rewatched the most. And I feel like a part of me has to include The Exorcist as well, even though, like, I saw it parts of it way too young. It scared the crap out of me. But because of that, like, I can't think of another, not just horror movie, but movie in general, that's had that much of a lasting impact on me. So I feel like I got to kind of include it.
For me, anyone who follows me on Twitter, I think probably knows my answer to this, or has listened to the podcast knows my answer to this. It's Nightmare on Elm Street. I've watched that movie more times than I can count. I rewatch it more often than just about any other movie, period. I've written more articles that touch on it, at least, than any other movie. Every time I watch it, I find more to love about it. And I just adore that movie.
What was the first horror movie you remember seeing?
Okay, so I had to do some serious YouTube research for this, but I think that, okay, the first full movie I saw in full, I think, was probably The Shining, which I watched at a sleepover, and I made my friend come upstairs and finish watching it upstairs with my parents because I was too afraid to finish it with her in the basement. But before that, it was the pea soup scene from The Exorcist. Billy Crystal hosted the Oscars in, I guess it was 2000, and they like put him into like, they superimposed him into a bunch of different scenes from famous movies, and they put him as Father Karras in the pea soup scene. And I saw that, and I was way too young. And when I tell you, it terrified me. Like, I was convinced possessed Linda Blair lived under my bed for literal years. No. I had like a nighttime ritual that I like couldn't, like, I couldn't move. I had to hold my breath for like 10 seconds, and then like she wouldn't get me. It was rough. So I like dug down the YouTube rabbit hole to try to find that. And yeah.
Oh, wow. I do remember that Billy Crystal like performance at the Oscars.
Yeah. It's surprising that like something it was. I watched it again today and it was literally like a 10-second clip. Ruined me.
My first one's actually really easy to answer because I remember it vividly, is Frankenstein, the 1931 version. It was just after we got our first VCR and my mom and brother went to the library to just see what they had. And they had some videos and they brought home one that they had known I was dying to see. And it was that. It was Frankenstein.
That's a great introduction to horror.
Yeah. Certainly is. It's, you know, considering I'm writing a classic horror column on Bloody Disgusting now, it's very appropriate that that's my first movie too, you know? I still am just obsessed with that period of horror.
Who would be your ultimate final girl?
I hope this isn't a cop-out because I said Scream was my favorite horror movie, but I feel like Sydney. She's great. She's a badass. She's put up with a lot of bullshit. And she always puts up a good fight. I feel like she's earned her status of epic final girl.
I don't feel like that's a cop-out at all.
No? Okay, good.
It's a good choice.
Okay.
If yours is a cop-out, mine's a cop-out because I'm saying Nancy Thompson. She's proactive. She goes into Freddy's world to face him directly. I hate the way she was killed in Nightmare 3. that just really doesn't feel entirely true to the character to me. But then I'm so glad that she kind of comes back in New Nightmare. Nancy is just a remarkable character and, my favorite final girl probably always will be.
She's very smart. Like, I like that she takes the fight to Freddy basically. How long would you last in a horror movie?
Okay, depends on the kind of horror movie. I think if it was like, if we're dealing with ghosts, paranormal stuff, I think I would last a long time because the second someone brought out a Ouija board, like I'd be noping out of there, like I'm having no part of this. So I like to think I would dodge the bullet in that movie. But if it was like zombies, slasher, like probably one of the first to go. I think I could maybe make it a little while, maybe the second or third.
Yeah, if it was a slasher, I don't know. I definitely wouldn't make it to the end. I wouldn't be like, you know, the guy that in the later Friday the 13th where they have a final guy that survives too. That wouldn't be me, but I think I'd make it a while because I'm fairly observant, I think, or I try to be. So.
Yeah, I like to think I'm resourceful. I don't know.
All right, so let's talk about The Exorcist now. The IMDb summary: when a 12-year-old girl is possessed by a mysterious entity, her mother seeks the help of two priests to save her. Do you remember, well, Austin, I know you remember the first time you saw The Exorcist, but tell me about your first exposure to it, what you thought, if you remember what you thought at the time.
Well, for me, it was, I used to check out books from the library on horror. And there was this book that was just like 70. It focused on 70s horror and it had pictures in it from The Exorcist. The one that they had was of Reagan floating. And before that, I heard that term, The Exorcist, because I think I went to church. I still go to church too. But as a kid, I remember the pastor mentioning a movie called The Exorcist. And I thought my mom like exercises. Is it like an exercise machine thing? I remember thinking something like that. But then when I saw the, you know, the floating picture, it's like, oh, okay, there's priests and I don't know what's going on. I didn't actually read the text. I just looked at the pictures in this book all the time. So when I finally saw the movie, it was a very different experience, obviously. I think I knew something more about the movie by the time I finally saw it. But I was prepared for the scariest experience ever. Maybe it wasn't that, but there were certainly elements that were shocking to me. Even when I must have been 11, maybe 12 when I saw it the first time.
And, oh my gosh.
Yeah, well.
I would not have been able to do it at 11 or 12.
No. Yeah, that was when I really tried to watch as many of the quote-unquote classics as I could, was around that. That's when I was reading a lot of Stephen King. I was I watched a bunch of Friday the 13th and the Elm Street movies and all of those things as well. And The Exorcist was kind of like, I found it at the library again, you know, and watched it there first. Not there. I obviously checked it out and brought it home, but that's how I saw the movie for the first time. It must have been in my early teens. And there were definitely things that were shocking, but there were other things like, I have no idea what's going on.
Austin, what about you? What the first time you actually saw the movie?
I tried multiple times to watch it all the way through after being scared as a kid. I tried to watch it a bunch of times as like a teenager. I read the book. I became fascinated with it because I think because it scared me so much, it like really took hold and I was fascinated by it. So like I read the book, I read a bunch of interviews, I watched a bunch of documentaries, I read the script, but I just like every time I tried to watch the movie, I would get a little further every time, but I'd chicken out. So I didn't watch it all the way through until like 2 years ago. Again, my co-host Jen finally sat down and made me watch it. So she was like my emotional support human for this. And like, I loved it. It was amazing. It's still very scary to me. That's kind of been my experience with it. Knowing maybe too much about it, but like I built it up for so many years in my mind that it's still scary, even if it might not be to other people, you know?
Yeah, same. I think I started watching horror movies when I was like early teens, like 12, 13 kind of thing. And I refused to watch The Exorcist. It was the one that I was like, nope, not going to do it. I'm not, I am not going to watch it. And I'm not religious in any way. So it wasn't that, the fear of that kept me from it, but I couldn't do it. And it wasn't until I was in my early to mid 20s when I was hanging out with a bunch of like other horror fans, like hardcore horror fans. And they're like, Sherry, you have to see The Exorcist. How have you not seen this yet? And when I watched it, I was like, this is so scary. But also it was like so good that I ended up seeing it. I went on Halloween one year to see it at a local movie theater and like by myself. None of my friends wanted to go, which was terrible. But, I had a good time. I dressed my best Halloween costume as an adult was as Reagan. I had, the nightgown on backwards and I was going to spill pea soup on my nightgown, but then I thought I'm just going to wear that around for the night. So that's not going to happen. But my makeup, my hair, like everything was just like so good.
That's amazing.
Okay. Well, so it was directed by William Friedkin. So apparently Alfred Hitchcock turned down the chance to acquire the screen rights to the novel and also turned down directing the film because another producer bought the rights. Stanley Kubrick wanted to direct it, but only, again, if he could produce it himself. But the studio was worried that he would spend too much money, go over schedule. So they went back and forth with some other directors. I think Mike Nichols was one. Peter Bogdanovich was another. Like a lot of different people that they were going to go with. William Peter Blatty, who wrote the novel, really wanted William Friedkin because he'd seen some of his work. He liked the kind of documentarian style that he had. So that's how we ended up with William Friedkin as the director. So William Peter Blatty also wrote the screenplay. He based the novel on the exorcism of Roland Doe, which is a case file from the Vatican involving the supposed possession of a boy in 1949 and his exorcism by two Jesuit priests. So obviously Blatty changed the names. He changed the gender of the victim. And he also like obviously elaborated and embellished a lot. So I looked at all the different casting options and I'm going to read through some of them. And I want you to tell me if you could picture who you would picture in the role.
Okay.
Potentially. All right. So Father Karras, Jack Nicholson, Al Pacino, Gene Hackman, Warren Beatty, Burt Reynolds. Roy Schneider, Dustin Hoffman, Marlon Brando, who is also considered for the role of Father Marin, George Hamilton, Alan Alda, Ryan O'Neill, Peter Fonda, Christopher Walken, James Caan, Paul Newman, Elliot Gould, Robert Blake, and John Voight. Can you see any of those in the role?
There's one you mentioned, but it flew out of my head. Oh,
geez. Oh, I know. There are so many.
Yeah. A lot of them, though, absolutely not.
I feel like Christopher Walken has been considered for every role in Hollywood. I feel like every time I'm looking at like possible like alternate castings, Christopher Walken's on that list.
That's true.
Maybe Ryan O'Neill, like visually, mm-hmm. I could kind of see that. Kind of that sympathetic character. I don't know.
It's interesting because I feel like a lot of them, maybe like back in the 70s, it would have been very different, right? Whereas now some mm-hmm. of them, like Jack Nicholson, I feel like has become kind of a character of Jack Nicholson.
Yes.
And so I think that maybe is influencing our thought process. But Audrey Hepburn was considered for Chris O'Neill.
I could see that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that would be a good casting. Mm-hmm. Actually, most of the suggested casting for Chris McNeil, I could see. So Debbie Reynolds, Shirley MacLaine, mm-hmm. Geraldine Page, Jane Fonda. Apparently, there's differing stories about Jane Fonda when she was offered the role. Supposedly, she said that the movie was a bunch of capitalist ripoff bullshit.
Sounds right.
Sounds like something she'd say, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But she said that she actually turned down the role because she didn't believe in fairy tales. So, Sharon Stone was also considered for the role, which just seems,
she I seems can't see that awfully either. Young in that period of time.
For Regan, we had Jamie Lee Curtis, Carrie Fisher, Melanie Griffith, Denise Nickerson, who played Violet Beauregard in the original Charlie and the Chocolate mm-hmm. Factory.
Oh, yeah.
Eve Plum, who was Jan on The Brady Bunch.
Uh-huh.
And Dana Plato, who is Kimberly on Different Strokes.
Different Strokes, yeah. You know, honestly, Carrie Fisher who'd you mention right before Carrie Fisher again? Jamie Lee Curtis. Yeah, I could picture either of them at that very young age doing that, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because they honestly kind of – they look a little bit like Linda Blair at that age.
Yeah.
So they have some of that sort of cherub-cheeked quality that Linda Blair has too, you know.
What if Debbie Reynolds had been cast as Chris and then Carrie Fisher was...
I wonder if that was that the consideration? Would it be like Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher together and like Janet Leigh and Jamie Lee Curtis together?
Ooh, Janet Leigh, that could have been interesting.
Yeah.
Apparently, the characters of Chris McNeil and Regan were based on Shirley MacLaine and her daughter. Because William Peter Blatty knew both of them. And McLean's actually talked about it in interviews, which is kind of interesting. But she didn't want to play it, although she did end up playing a role similar, I think, the next year. This is the film debut of Jason Miller, who received an Oscar nomination for his role as Father Karras. And originally, Stacey Keach was cast to play Father Karras, but then William Friedkin spotted Jason Miller in a play, I think Year of Champions or Championship Year, something like that.
That championship season.
That's it. Thank you. They ended up buying out Keach's contract because he really wanted Jason Miller. I can't picture anyone else as Father Karras. Like, he's just so magnetic.
You get the sense that he's very haunted, that Jason Miller is – he's just kind of that guy while you're watching the movie. And I think Keach would have been fantastic because he's just an incredible actor. But I don't know that there would be that same level of pathos there just because Jason Miller just seems so much like he's that guy.
I'm not super familiar with Jason Miller, but I guess he wasn't super well known at this point, right? Because I think that Friedkin kind of realized that it should be someone that people didn't already have an associated kind of idea of.
He hadn't made a movie before. He was pretty much on like in theater at that point. I don't think So the movie going public wouldn't be super exposed to him. So the original shooting schedule was 85 days, but filming in America lasted for 224 days.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, I mean, they did have the set burned to the ground, which caused a three-week delay. Jason Miller's son was injured during filming. Shooting in Iraq was so hot that some of the crew members grew ill and had to be replaced. The original teaser trailer consisted of nothing but images of the white-faced demon quickly flashing in and out of darkness, and it was actually banned in many theaters as it was deemed too frightening. Those people probably should not go see the movie then if that was too frightening for them. Although that is some of the, like, when you get flashes of the demon face, that is kind of unsettling for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was released on December 26, 1973. Upon its initial theatrical release, the film affected many audiences so strongly that paramedics had to be called in to treat people who went into hysterics, who fainted. It just caused a lot of drama, basically, at the theaters. Siskel and Ebert both gave The Exorcist 4 stars.
Mm-hmm.
Considering Gene Siskel hated horror movies, that's pretty impressive. He gave thumbs down to Poltergeist, to Aliens, to Silence of the Lambs. He hated anything where he felt like children were in jeopardy. And he complained about that in Poltergeist, but he really loved The Exorcist and said that the ending was so moving that he actually had a very different take on that versus some other horror movies. Vincent Canby, writing in the New York Times, dismissed The Exorcist as a chunk of elegant occultist claptrap, a practically impossible film to sit through. It establishes a new low for grotesque special effects.
Wow.
Yeah, not a fan, not a fan. The budget was $12 million. Any ideas what the box office was?
$80
million? Yeah, somewhere in that ballpark. I'll say $90.
$441.3 million.
Wow.
When adjusted for inflation, it's the highest grossing R-rated film of all time, or it was until It Chapter One came out a few years ago.
Huh.
Huh. Well, there we go.
I was shocked. I would not have anticipated that much.
Yeah, we undershot a little there.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I was thinking, wasn't Jaws the first? I thought Jaws was the first movie to make over $100 million, so I guess I was thinking along those lines.
Maybe this is like box office season, I mean, with re-releases and stuff.
Could be.
Perhaps.
Could be.
The cumulative.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the movie opens on an exterior shot of an upper window of a house, and the lights turn off as the camera pans to the street before transitioning to a close-up of a statue of the Virgin Mary. And the credits begin over a screeching sound before we hear prayers in Arabic. So we've now transitioned from the United States to Iraq, specifically to an archaeological dig. The first words the audience hears are Allahu Akbar, or God is great. This dig site is the actual site of ancient Nineveh in Hatra, Iraq. Friedkin had to take an all-British crew to film there because the U.S. Had no diplomatic relations with Iraq at the time. So by taking the British crew, they were allowed to film near ancient buildings and archaeological digs, but they also had to give something back in exchange. So they had to teach Iraqi filmmakers advanced film techniques, as well as how to make fake blood, which I love. It's very dusty, it's loud, and men are chiseling away before we follow a young boy who tells an old man that they found something. So this old man is Father Marin, played by Max von Sydow. So in the movie, how old do you think he's supposed to be in the movie?
I think he's supposed to be in his 70s.
Yeah. I know they aged him up a lot.
Yeah. He was only in his 30s.
Yeah, he was very young when he made that movie.
It's wild.
It's like, you would think that they would have picked somebody else. Like, I don't know what would have crossed their mind to be like, let's cast this guy and age him 40 years for the entire movie.
Yeah, I don't know what the thinking on that was. It's pretty effective, I think. Like, it looks pretty good, but yeah, it's an odd choice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad they did, though, because I think that von Sydow brings something to that role. You know, he was in almost Bergman films and stuff, so there's just so much, I think, a level of gravitas that he brings to it.
Yes.
That I'm not sure an American actor, even a British actor, would have brought, who was closer to the age. So, and he still was relatively unknown in America. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad they went with Vancito, though, for those reasons and more.
Oh, yeah. He's perfect in it.
He really is. So there's this little cavity that they've unearthed, and Father Marin finds the sculpture of a demon head inside, as well as
Pazuzu.
Pazuzu.
who's not actually named until the second one.
We learned that in
the second one, yeah.
And he also finds a medallion. It's not from the same era. It's not the same religion. So he's kind of like, oh, what's this doing
here? Isn't it a St. Christopher medal?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. I don't know positively that it's St. Christopher, but it's a saint's medal from obviously a Catholic saint's medal. Yeah.
He then proceeds to a cafe where he drinks his tea and he shakily takes his nitroglycerin pills. So this man is clearly not well. Mm-hmm. But the opening 10 to 15 minutes of this movie are filled with absolute foreboding. Like, he's making his way through town. He almost gets run over by a horse driven carriage that's just barreling his way with this little old woman in it.
The look on her face as a kid. I mean, I was like, that kind of freaked me out. That was one of those things. It was like, something about that was just so creepy.
Mm-hmm. Apparently the Iraqi woman that she was 109 years old.
Oh, wow.
When they filmed that scene. So he wanders through the ruins alone, and shadows are cast on him by the statue of Pazuzu, and dogs are fighting and growling. Like, it's just a very heavy scene. Like, it just feels very, well, I already said foreboding. What's another word for foreboding?
Well, it's kind of the perfect word for it.
Yeah.
Foreboding is the word. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can totally see why this movie won Best Sound. Like, right off the bat, all the there's the metal smithers like banging on, like all the sounds piling on top of each other. It's overwhelming, and it's just, yeah, it's foreboding. It's amazing.
And that shot where he is on the right hand of the screen and he's facing the statue, which is on the left, you know that he's going to face off with that demon later on in the movie. Mm-hmm. So we move to Georgetown, where we meet Chris McNeil, who is studying her scripts while lying in bed. And Ellen Burstyn is an absolute genius. She's so good in this movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She hears some scraping noises and crashes coming from the attic, so she gets up to investigate. And she looks in on her daughter, who is fast asleep. She notices a window wide open and closes it, which seems fairly insignificant, but it happens throughout the movie, and there are some key things that happen with the window open. So, the next morning, she attributes the sounds to rats and asks Carl, who works for her, to pick up some traps. Traps aren't going to help, though.
No rats.
Poor Carl.
I love that guy.
Oh, yeah. He's such a sad character. He gets so abused.
Yes, mm-hmm. I know.
So Chris is in Georgetown. She's filming her latest movie, Crash Course, with director Burke Dennings. They are filming on location at Georgetown University, and we see this handsome priest watching the proceedings. There are a lot of moments in the movie that Friedkin called grace shots, and Chris walking home from the set is one of them. So we see her walk by children in their Halloween costumes. We see two nuns with their habits blowing behind them in the wind, and the leaves are falling. Doesn't really serve a purpose, but it's just a beautiful scene.
And isn't that where the introduction of the Tubular Bells music starts too?
Yes.
Oh, gosh, I love that touch. So much of the music in the movie is 20th century dissonant music, Penderecki and George Crumb and stuff. And so to hear that melody, mm-hmm. I don't know, something about it just really sets a tone. And it's not during a frightening sequence or anything, but it's very memorable and it really works for me.
Can I tell a quick story about this?
Of course.
We were at my trivia team was at a trivia night, and we there was like a music round, and one of the songs in the music round, we had to identify the title of the song and the artist, and it was Tubular Bells, which we knew right away. And so we wrote it down. And then for a bonus point, the host was like, bonus point, if you can tell us what horror movie theme this sounds like. So we're all like, oh, perfect. It's The Exorcist. No, he had made it somehow a subjective question and was like, it sounds like the Halloween theme. So the answer is Halloween. And we're like, no, but it is literally the theme to The Exorcist. And we got into like a screaming match with the trivia host over this. So ridiculous. Every time I hear that, it just brings up memories of just anger.
that's not Halloween.
That's not how this works. Oh, so frustrating.
It really doesn't sound that much like the theme from Halloween.
No, like I get what he's saying, like similar ideas,
I guess.
The minimalistic qualities to it. But I'm like, it's no.
Chris hears someone talking as she walks by a church. And this is kind of our first introduction to Father Karras. And he's talking to another priest about feeling like a fraud. He tells him everyone feels that way. It's just kind of a throwaway scene, but it really sets that tone of his character. So she gets home, we meet Sharon, her assistant, and Regan, her 12-year-old daughter. I love this scene because it gives you a glimpse of the two of them being playful. They're happy before the nightmare begins. You see them both in full health. They're like, you know, she is just a young 12-year-old girl who is playful and she's happy. And she's, I think, Brian, you said cherub-cheeked. Like, she's just adorable, right?
And yeah, she really is. Well, it's funny because, okay, my wife like viscerally dislikes horror movies, and we watched Midsommar together, and her reaction was I think I'm gonna throw up. I literally, when it ended, she actually felt physically ill.
So I had
this on earlier today, and she walks in during that scene and she goes, oh, what's this? And I said, it's The Exorcist. And she says, this looks like a nice movie. I was like, well, this is establishing that their relationship, while things are still okay, the crucifix masturbating comes later. So she's like, okay, I'll leave now.
We see Father Karras as he emerges from a set of stairs onto a train platform, and a homeless man asks if he can help an old altar boy. He kind of looks disgusted, and he ignores him. And he goes to visit his mother in her apartment. She is the doting mom, but she's not doing very well. And we'll see throughout the movie that he carries a lot of guilt about her and her situation. So he wants to move her somewhere else so she's not alone, instead of just in this apartment where she doesn't have a lot of contact with other people. So this actress was discovered by William Friedkin in a Greek restaurant. She'd never acted in a movie before, but he selected her because she bore a resemblance to his mom. And William Peter Blatty also thought that she looked like his mom.
Oh.
Isn't it? That's so cute.
That's so sweet.
Back in Georgetown, Chris discovers that Reagan has been playing with a Ouija board, and she does it all the time on her own, she says.
Nope.
Don't you need two people for that?
You're supposed to have two people.
that's what Chris says, I think.
Oh, that's right. Yes. She's like, no. Yeah, that's right.
No.
The planchette flies away from Chris when she tries to put her hands on it. And Reagan says, Captain Howdy doesn't want you to play. Right there, I'd be like, I'm breaking this thing and burning it. Although I guess you're not supposed to break them. I don't know.
This is why I'm noping out the second a Ouija board comes into play.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I talk a lot about how I'm a skeptic, but there are some things that I will not mess around with because I'm like, I don't want to be proven wrong.
Why can't it?
Yeah, exactly. Later that night, Chris is tucking her in, and we see that Reagan has been reading a movie magazine with the headline Trouble in the McNeil Marriage on the front of it. And this is kind of a recurring theme. People are often like, oh, are you divorced? Where's your husband? And like, they think that this is somehow caused the problems that Reagan goes through. They proceed to make plans for her upcoming birthday, and Reagan tells her mom that she can bring Burke Dennings. You like him, right? Aren't you going to marry him? And one of my favorite throwaway lines in the movie is, I like pizza too, but I'm not going to marry it.
Relatable.
Right? Exactly. Later, we learn that the father isn't exactly going to win Dad of the Year. He can't even call her on her birthday.
Yeah, that seems rough.
Yeah.
Well, just the screaming on the phone of it, they show Reagan just kind of hearing it, as I recall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's brutal. Brutal to see a kid having to deal with that kind of thing going on over her, you know?
And you can see how maybe this could cause some kind of, you know, mental distress for a child. So, I mean, it makes sense that people like the doctors, and even I think Father Karras at one point asks about her dad. So, I mean, it makes sense that that's something that is considered. I mean, it's probably more likely than, you know, demon possession. But Father Karras is at a bar with another priest. He tells him that he wants out of his job. He's just not the person to counsel other priests on their struggles with their faith, as he thinks he's lost his faith. That's kind of that's one of the biggest themes in the movie, is people losing or finding their faith. Mm-hmm. Chris, for instance, she doesn't identify as a religious person at all. She doesn't think that Reagan is religious. And in fact, when she finds the crucifix later on, she's like, who put this here? Like, who is this? And she questions her staff.
Right.
There's more rattling in the attic. Chris wakes up to find her in bed, and she says she can't sleep because her bed was shaking. This time, Chris decides to look up in the attic, but the power's out. So instead, she lights a candle. And Austin, I feel like this is also where you would nope out.
Yeah, I'm not going up to that attic.
Same.
No way.
No. These people don't watch horror movies. Seriously.
No.
No.
You don't go investigate sounds.
In their defense, the slasher boom hadn't started yet.
Okay, so. Fair. That's fair. That's fair. It was just around the corner.
Yeah.
She lights a candle, and it's creepy. She's exploring the attic looking for something, and her candle flares. Like, it's like there's gas or something up there. Mm-hmm. And Carl pops up his head to say, "There's nothing. No rats."
I told you, no rats.
And we get another little quick scene. There's a lot of like little quick throwaway scenes. Well, not necessarily throwaway scenes, but very quick scenes. Like this one where a priest arrives to church in the morning and he finds the statue of the Virgin Mary desecrated. Mm-hmm. Now, apparently, and I've read the book, but I don't remember this. Austin, you said you've read the book, right?
Yeah, it was a couple years ago. I don't know how well I remember it.
Brian, have you read the book?
I have.
Okay.
Long time ago, but yeah. But I do remember this section quite well for whatever reason, because I was – I found that section where he describes the Black Mass for pages mm-hmm. to be actually really fascinating. I assume that's where you were going with that.
A little bit. I was also – I think there's also – there's a hint in the book, which I'm trying to remember, and I can't mm-hmm. quite – that was actually Reagan had actually gone and desecrated the church.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because there's something about the clay, and they find the clay in her house. And I think, you know, we see that later with Lieutenant Kinderman finding the sculpture, but
– That makes sense. Yeah, that sounds
I great. Remember the desecration in the book being much more expansive and descriptive mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, it's kind of just a shot, right, in the movie.
Yeah, it's just a single shot in the movie, yeah. Which is enough. You get the point.
You do, yeah. Now, Reagan is at the doctor's getting some tests done. And it's interesting because you haven't really seen a lot of what's been going on with her, like other than the fact that she can't sleep, her bed was shaking. You haven't seen a lot that would cause you to think that she needs to go for tests to figure out what's going on. But clearly there's other things going on that we're not aware of. And Linda Blair is so vulnerable mm-hmm. Throughout the movie, but I find particularly in any of the scenes with medical procedures where that's almost as scary as the like possession stuff.
For me, these are the most disturbing scenes in the movie.
And I think that's where a lot of the audience reactions happened. Like, I think that a lot of the passing out happened in the medical scenes,
yes.
less so than the possession scenes.
This is our first glimpse of the white demon face that will flash on screen randomly. And apparently, these were rejected makeup tests for her possessed appearance. Mm-hmm. She starts to act out at the doctor's office. She grabs the thermometer and is like, "I don't want it." And then she's humming, acting kind of disoriented before she collapses to the ground. The doctor diagnoses her with a disorder of the nerves and prescribes Ritalin for her condition. This is the first time that somebody says, "Oh, this could be related to depression over her parents' separation. So let's just wait and see what happens with the Ritalin." We learn that she's been acting out of character. She's been lying. Chris talks about her lying about the bed shaking. And she swears at the doctor quite colorfully. but he's like, "Don't worry. It's normal with like this sort of thing." So while Chris is worried about her daughter, Father Karras is dealing with his mother, who's now been hospitalized at a psychiatric hospital, as her edema has affected her brain, according to Father Karras's uncle. So the scene in the hospital is so heartbreaking because we see all of these women in different states of mental distress. Some of them are completely disconnected. Some of them plead with Father Karras for help because they're like, oh, it's a priest. Like, he's going to help us. And he can't. He can't help his mother. And the agony is all over his face when she asks him, why did you do this to me, Dimmy? Mm-hmm. He wants to take her home. They can't afford a private hospital. He goes home. He's a fighter. We've seen pictures in his room of him, like, boxing. So he goes and takes his frustrations out on a punching bag. Chris is having a party at her house, and there is a very eclectic mix of guests.
Yeah, that's a crazy party, isn't it?
It looks like a fun party.
Yeah.
There's the singing priest.
Yeah, Father Dyer.
I love Father Dyer. Yep. Yeah. There's astronauts. There's Hollywood people, including her director, Burke Dennings, who, let's be honest, he's a jerk.
Oh, yeah, he's awful. Yeah.
He's a horrible person.
He's also extremely drunk.
He is extremely drunk. That is true.
Yeah.
He ribs Carl about being a Nazi. He calls him a butchering pig. Like, he's just particularly nasty to poor Carl.
Yeah.
Chris has a conversation with Father Dyer, and she asks him about the handsome priest that she's seen at St. Mike's. And he says, that's Damien Karras. And we now learn that Damien's mother has passed away. Mm-hmm. So we know that's going to be a cause of some turmoil for Father Karras as well. So Burke gets into a fight with Carl after again insulting him, and they send Burke on his way. Chris goes up to check on Reagan. The window is once again open, and she comes back downstairs. Folks are singing around the piano. Father Dyer has his line about how his version of heaven is, what does he say, an all-white nightclub?
Yeah, and I'm the headliner, and they love me.
Yes.
Hey, I get that, you know, as a sort of musician myself, you know.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
The singing stops as Reagan enters the room, and she stares at the astronaut and very creepily says, you're going to die up there, before she pees on the carpet.
Yeah. And this is where I checked out of the movie when I was a teenager. It's like, I can't handle this anymore.
I wanted to know, like, does the astronaut survive his, like, trip into space?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think he probably does.
Probably.
Once she's cleaned up and back in bed, she asks Chris, what's wrong with me? And Chris reassures her, but then runs back into the room when she hears Reagan scream. Now, the lights flicker in the sconce. That's a sign. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's when you should call in the priest, I feel like, but you know, it's just me. So she comes into the room and she sees the bed violently shaking, and Reagan is basically being tossed around. So things are not good in the McNeil household.
Yeah.
Father Dyer has gone to see his friend, Father Karras, to console him. And he brings, booze with him, the good stuff. He gets them all tucked into bed, and then Father Karras starts to dream. So there's random images, like we see a saint's medallion falling. There's a black dog running. There's a pendulum on a clock that's frozen. His mother's coming up the subway stairs as he waves at her across the street. Another demon face flashes, and his mother turns around and goes back down into the subway station. The dream really reminded me of Rosemary's Baby. Like, it felt like that kind of dream. Yeah. He goes and delivers mass for his mother, and you can see the doubt in his face. He is really, really struggling with his belief, which I will say, like, so personal story. I am an atheist, but what triggered my atheism was when my grandfather died. I struggled with, like, my faith, and I was younger. I was like 12 years old at the time. But that was kind of what kickstarted my loss of faith. So I can relate, like, to him, like, just being like, you know what, like, he is struggling, and particularly he's already been struggling with this, and then his mother dies, and it just kind of pushes that loss of faith a little further down the road, I think.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And this whole movie, you know, Karras's story is so powerful, you know, for me as a person of faith, but who also has had plenty of doubt and struggle and all of those things along the way, being privy to all of that as the movie goes through his arc and his story is so powerful to me. Mm-hmm. And this is a remarkable, the core of this movie really is Karis's crisis of faith.
Regan has to go back to the doctor for more tests. Now the doctor thinks it's something with her temporal lobe. She's having convulsions. Chris says that wasn't a convulsion. The whole bed was shaking. And she really struggles with the diagnosis of a seizure disorder. But the doctor's like, if it's just a lesion, we just need to remove the scar. It's fine. And as we talked about, the medical procedures are really hard to watch. And this is the worst one.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. she has an arteriogram.
Right.
The man playing the doctor is an actual neurosurgeon in real life. She's very believable as this young, scared girl who is going through like a really scary time. So we see her carotid gets punctured and blood spurts. And it's not a lot, but it's
more than I
seeing this as a kid was. This really, really disturbed me. This was so horrible to see.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's also where you start to see a subtle shift in her appearance. Like she's starting to look unwell. Mm-hmm. She's got chapped lips. The coloring in her face is not what it was.
Yeah, kind of the dark circles start forming under her mm-hmm. eyes and things like that too. Yeah.
And the sounds of the medical equipment, every time there is a medical procedure, the sounds are so loud and they're so jarring and mm-hmm. it just makes the scene even more uncomfortable. Like they don't cushion those sounds at all.
That clanking sound mm-hmm. is just kind of invades your dreams, you know?
Yeah. The doctors view the images of her brain. They determine there's nothing there. But then they're called to the McNeil residence where things are getting progressively worse. So at this point, Regan is being flung around on her bed. This is actually where Linda Blair injured her back, when a piece of the rig that she was on that was basically moving her up and down mm-hmm. broke. And so she hurt her back. Ellen Burstyn also was hurt in a later scene when she is thrown away from Regan and a harness jerked her heart away from the bed and she fell and hurt mm-hmm. her back as well.
And that's also the take that's in the movie.
Yeah, of course. Right?
Yeah. And she was not too pleased with Billy Friedkin over that.
Yeah, well, it was take after take after take after yeah. take.
And I think he sounds like somebody that I would not want to work with. Like he fired off guns to get to startle them. And
mm-hmm. yeah.
I love the interviews with the actors though later are really interesting because, you know, Ellen Burstyn's, she kind of takes it in stride. She goes, you know, my friend, Billy Friedkin is a madman, you know? And then, Max von Sydow says something like, some of his methods were not what I was used to, you know, that sort of thing. And I just love seeing those kinds of interviews, later, because some people were just like pissed off about it. It's mm-hmm. like, how dare he do this? And others, you know, looking back, they're kind of like, you know, we made our movie. Weird. It's just he got what he wanted.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it was a Shelley Duvall, Stanley Kubrick kind of relationship.
No,
so
no.
Regan cries to her mother to make it stop, and her eyes turn white, and she growls. And she has this huge lump just growing in her throat.
I don't think I had noticed that before until today. Yeah,
it's
awful. Really interesting is, you know, that's Dick Smith, you know, sort of early version of these bladder effects that he would employ in like Altered States and then in, you know, Scanners and then were used in The Howling and American Werewolf. So it's a simple one. It's not as complex as those, but it's really bizarrely effective.
Mm-hmm. So this is where the demon enters the picture. As one of the doctors approaches to help her, she stands up on the bed and backhands him. She knocks him down and in a demonic voice says, keep away, the sow is mine.
Yeah.
Friedkin apparently originally wanted to use Linda Blair's voice, deepen it electronically, roughen it up a little bit, but he felt like it maybe didn't have quite the drama that he wanted. So in the Leap of Faith documentary, he talks about how he wanted a voice that wasn't really masculine, wasn't really feminine, very androgynous, kind of a rough voice. And he went with actress Mercedes McCambridge,
mm-hmm.
who insisted on swallowing raw eggs and chain smoking to change her vocals. And despite the fact that she'd had problems with alcohol abuse in the past, she wanted to drink whiskey because she knew that that would change her voice even more and create the state of mind that she needed for the character.
Yeah.
That's rough. Like
method acting there.
Yeah. But apparently, didn't she have a spiritual advisor or something on in the recording sessions with her, though, too?
I think that was one of her stipulations. She needed a priest or something.
Yeah.
She also asked them to tie her to a chair because she was supposed to be a demon struggling, right, against, like, its restraints. Right. But she never got credit originally for her voicing the demon. And in fact, Linda Blair was nominated for Best Supporting Actress that year before people knew that Mercedes McCambridge had actually done the voice of Pazuzu. Apparently, once you are given a nomination, it cannot be withdrawn. And so it's believed that the controversy over her being given credit for McCambridge's work ruined her chances of winning the award, which I think is sad because she still, regardless, did a phenomenal performance.
Well, yeah, and according, I mean, the story goes round and round in circles. Who knows what the actual truth is? But Friedkin says that Mercedes McCambridge said, no, give all the credit to that little girl. I don't need my credit on the screen. But then after the nomination came out and stuff like that, was saying, hey, wait a minute. Why don't I have credit on the screen? And he says, because you told me not to. And so all these things, I mean, honestly, if Friedkin is remembering correctly or not, who knows?
Yeah.
You can't know for sure what the reality was, but I think she was given in later prints and after the first run of prints of the movie was actually given credit on it, but in the first original run of it, she was not. So who knows what the real story there is, but man, that's just a tough situation to find yourself in. Whether it was, hey, I performed this and I didn't get credit, or in Friedkin's case, you're coming after me when you said you didn't want it. You know, either way, it's a tough situation. So either way the story goes.
And a situation that puts Linda Blair kind of in the middle of it.
It does, yeah. Which is too bad. I mean, she was, obviously, this was early work for her. She didn't have a lot of Hollywood clout. So what could she do, you know, either?
Reagan gets more and more profane, and an invisible hand slaps her across the face, leaving a handprint before the doctors manage to sedate her. The doctors are still trying to rationalize what has happened before Chris loses it, saying it's like she's psychotic or she has a split personality. They still think it's something physical, though, so they recommend another procedure. This time, and I will probably pronounce this incorrectly, a pneumoencephalograph. Never mind, I'm not going to try and say it. Basically, another procedure where spinal fluid is drained from the brain through a lumbar puncture, which is just awful. So again, the procedure is agonizing. Again, the x-rays are completely normal. So it's a bit of a head scratcher. They're like, maybe now we should get a psychiatrist involved. But not before tragedy strikes. Chris arrives home. We see a crowd and first responders gathered at the steps near her home. She drives past them, however, before heading into the house. So lights are flickering in the kitchen. There's a shot where she is in darkness with only a small amount of blue light on her face. The lights flicker again, and we see the white demon face reflected on the rain shed.
Yeah,
that's I wanted to mention those. Those aren't. I rewatched the original cut.
Oh, the and these are in the cut.
And those were added in the re-release. I can't remember what year that was re-released. I saw it in the theater. When it was re-released. And so I noticed all of those things. And that range hood was one of the things where you see those images of Pazuzu, of the demon, of the white-faced demon. And I think those are cool additions. Those are additions to the director, or that it's not a director's cut. It's the version you've never seen.
The version you've never seen,
Yeah, is what they called it. That I think are really cool. Those are things that I think were nice, sort of cool additions. There's another element that I don't particularly like, but you know, we'll get to that.
I'm intrigued.
I love that moment with where his face pops up there, because I think, like I said before, I watched it all the way through. I feel like I knew all the beats, right? I'd done so much research on the movie. Like I said, I'd read the script. Like I know all the scares. I know what's coming. I didn't know that one was coming. Mm. And so it like was a pure jump scare for me, like totally got me. And I'm like, I think I turned to my friend Jen, who was watching it with me. I'm like, oh, this is why people like horror movies. Like, that was a great feeling. So I really liked that moment. It was really effective.
Yeah. Like I said, those are really effective additions, you know, those little subliminal pieces that were added, that I think were already in the original cut in different places. There are subliminal moments like that. They just added a few more of them that, and I think those are pretty cool.
She calls it to Sharon, but Sharon's not there. No one's home. So Chris goes to check on Reagan. The window is wide open yet again, and the room is so cold you can actually see her breath. So that bedroom set was cooled with 4 air conditioners, and temperatures would plunge below 30 degrees, which I think is below 0 in Celsius. So it was so cold.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. It was so cold that perspiration would actually freeze on the cast and crew. And apparently, at one point, the air was saturated with so much moisture that a thin layer of snow fell on the set before they arrived for filming. And to this day, Linda Blair says she hates being cold.
Yeah.
Especially like, when she's in those bedroom scenes, she is just in a nightgown. Like she is, you know, Chris usually comes in and she's got like a shawl around her or something. And
yeah, apparently Linda Blair was the only one who didn't get a cold or didn't get the flu or anything, didn't get sick. So
Sharon at this point has come home, and Chris tears into her for leaving Reagan alone. She's like, I didn't. I left her with Burke because I went to get more Thorazine. So we're like, well, where's Burke? Well, someone's at the door, and he is the bearer of bad news. Burke is dead. He must have been drunk and fallen down the stairs, breaking his neck. Poor Chris. She has been through a lot already, but she's going to go through so much more. And this is like kind of just the first very bad thing that will happen to her. She turns to Sharon, and then she gasps because Reagan comes spider walking down the stairs, blood dripping from her mouth.
Yep.
Yeah. Again, not in the original cut.
Apparently it was deleted because Friedkin thought that it appeared too early in the movie. So kind of like that Jaws thing where we don't want to show the shark right away. He didn't want to show that. But then he later admitted that it was also because there was no way to hide the wires from view. And so when he could actually remove them digitally, that's when he put it back in.
Interesting. That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The screen goes black and we see Reagan being hypnotized. She is slumped in the chair. She looks exhausted. She's asked if someone's inside her. She says, sometimes. Is it Captain Howdy? I don't know. The psychiatrist asks the person inside her to come forward, and her face changes like so dramatically.
Yeah.
She becomes more demonic and she growls and attacks him. And the shot of the psychiatrist falling backwards feels like a little nod to Psycho when the detective is walking up the stairs and is attacked and he falls back. It seems very similar. We are now introduced to a key character in the Exorcist franchise, Lieutenant Kinderman, who is played by Lee J. Cobb, one of his final roles before his death. He would end up being played by, oh my gosh, why can't I think of his name?
George C. Scott.
George C. Scott, thank you, in The Exorcist 3. He's come to talk to Father Karras, who is doing laps at the university's track, and they immediately have this banter. They talk about, you know, who they look like. I think Karras says, has anybody ever told you you look like Paul Newman? And the detective looks nothing like Paul Newman. So Kinderman has come to ask him about Burke Denning's death and witchcraft because he's made a connection between the desecrations at the church and Denning's death. Does that seem like a big leap for him to make?
It did until you mentioned the thing about the book where they find the clay. I'm like, oh, okay, maybe that's like the missing connection that they maybe don't make enough of in the movie. But yeah, it does seem like a really big leap.
But he says that, you know, Denning's head was turned all the way around and it's unlikely that it happened in the fall. Karras then realizes that Kinderman thinks that it could be a priest. Kinderman says, as the campus psychiatrist, you might have some insight into who could have done it. And I feel like regardless of the case in California that Kinderman references. If a priest talked to Father Karras about this, he is A, a psychiatrist, and B, their priest. So I feel like he's protected. Like, right. He does not have to tell them anything. Karras says he doesn't know of anyone that could have done it, but he wouldn't tell him even if he did. And Kinderman invites him to the movies. And this kind of becomes a running thing throughout the film and through The Exorcist 3. Meanwhile, Reagan is being treated at a clinic. Her physical appearance has continued to deteriorate. She has scratches all over her face. Her lips are horribly chapped. The doctors say, we think she's under the impression that she's been possessed. So an exorcism might work because she'll believe that it works. So it is the patient's belief in possession and the ritual that makes the exorcism effective. Because there aren't really demons, right?
One of the things that I like about the movie is that it, at least earlier on, it leaves the option open for it to definitely not be a possession, for it to truly be all in her mind. So it's really only later that, you know, with certain special effects and things like that that occur that make it pretty much impossible for it to be merely, you know, psychosomatic or something in her mind. That's one of the strengths of the movie, is just this, is it or isn't it, that happens through so much of this early section.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of Rosemary's Baby, is because it's similar. Like, I always think when I watch Rosemary's Baby, right up until almost the very end, I'm like, is this all in her head? Like, is she just thinking these things are happening, but they're really not? Like, and it's very similar with this, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Reagan and Chris return home, and Chris finds the cross put under Reagan's pillow. So as we talked about earlier, she's already told the doctors they aren't religious. So she questions her staff, and she's mad because she thinks somebody's put these religious ideas in Reagan's head. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Kinderman has been investigating the scene of Denning's death, and he finds a clay sculpture at the foot of the stairs. So he shows up at the house to ask Chris some questions. Would Dennings have been in Reagan's room? He has a theory that Dennings was killed by a very powerful man and then pushed from the window in Reagan's room. So he says, did you have any visitors, any deliveries that day? And Chris is like, no, like none of that. Like none of that happened. And why would he be in her room? It doesn't make any sense to her. So she goes to get him more coffee, and he finds some clay sculptures like the one he found at the foot of the stairs on like kind of a windowsill. And we see a little more of Lieutenant Kinderman, the film nerd, when he asks for Chris's autograph before leaving, saying, it's for his daughter, but then really it's for him. So it's just this cute little moment.
I like that part.
Yeah, he kind of has a Columbo-esque vibe to him.
Yeah.
Just kind of this like goofy, but he's actually really savvy detective. Mm-hmm. And now it's time for the infamous masturbation scene. Chris hears her daughter arguing with the demonic voice. So, of course, she runs upstairs and she finds Reagan masturbating with a crucifix covered in blood. And there's this perversion of their relationship when she forces Chris's face to her groin and she's like, lick me, before slapping her across the face. Sharon comes running upstairs. The door slams shut. A chair flies against it before the wardrobe comes hurtling towards Chris. I think this is the scene that she was hurt in, wasn't it?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. It is, because when there's this shot where they show her sort of fly across the floor and she grabs her back a little bit. Yeah, that's the scene. She actually hurt her back during that.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Because Friedkin basically said to the grip, let her have it.
Yeah. Apparently she asked them, like, this is really hurting me. He's pulling too hard. Can we take it easy? And so he, like, Friedkin told the grip, like, okay, yeah, I let up a little bit, and he just refused.
Reagan's head turns backwards, not the full 360 yet. And she says in a British accent, do you know what she did, your cunting daughter? That's a terrible British accent.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Burke's voice. Yeah. Yeah.
This is kind of the first hint that you get that maybe Burke was killed by Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
This scene is incredibly shocking, but it was actually toned down from the book. So it's longer.
In the book, as I recall, it's like it's more sensual kind of how she's doing it. Instead of just sort of whacking the thing at herself, it's
Now, you know, the doctors haven't worked, so it's time to bring in the priest. So this is where Chris and Father Karras finally meet. And she starts asking him about exorcisms. How do you go about getting an exorcism? And his line about how you'd have to I think he says something about
getting a time machine.
Time machine and travel back to the 16th century. Yeah. He says they don't really happen anymore. We've learned about mental illness. So he is still, like, he thinks as a psychiatrist. But he's like, I will see her as a psychiatrist. And she's like, just help her. Like, please just help her. And Ellen Burstyn is so fragile, so heartbreaking. Her face is still bruised from Reagan slapping her.
That part, that line where she just goes, she's already seen every fucking psychiatrist in the world. Mm-hmm. She needs a priest.
Yeah.
That part just hits me so hard every time.
Yeah.
Phil. Just that desperation of a parent who just wants to help their child and can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's like willing to try things that she wouldn't have, right? Like she is, exactly. She's not a religious person, but exactly. She's like, I'm willing to do anything to save my child. Mm-hmm. Karras comes face to face with Reagan, who is strapped down to the bed, and she is looking rough. She has vomit on her face. Her skin is discolored and mottled and scratched up. Her eyes are sunken. She claims to be the devil and says that Reagan is in here with us. And the demon starts playing games with Karras, mimicking the homeless man from the train platform, then saying that his mother is in there with him. And Karras is not going to be toyed with emotionally yet and asks what his mother's maiden name is. Rather than answering, the demon projectile vomits all over him. Apparently, this was supposed to hit Jason Miller in the chest, but there was a misfire and it hit him in the face. So when he looks shocked and disgusted, that is legitimately him looking shocked and disgusted.
Yeah, I don't blame him.
Yeah, no doubt.
For the vomiting sequences, there was a double for Linda Blair named mm-hmm. Elaine Dietz, and she actually later sued unsuccessfully for credit as the vomiter, I guess. So Father Karras and Chris confer in the laundry room. Chris cleans up his shirt. He tells her that he doesn't want to do more harm than good. So he needs evidence that the church would accept. He's like, there are no experts in possession. He's not even sure what evidence he needs. But one of the things that he suggests is knowledge of a language that she didn't know before. If she can speak a language that she didn't know, that's one of the things that they can use as proof. Chris says, that thing upstairs isn't my daughter. And she is vehement as she says, you tell me that you know an exorcism wouldn't do any good. She is fighting for her daughter, this woman.
Yeah. I love how she advocates for her.
Karras begins to investigate further. He listens to tapes of Reagan talking to her dad, but his crisis of faith is still raging. And we see him do the rite of communion, but he just kind of leaves everything there. He doesn't partake himself. And I think he's just doing it alone. He doesn't seem to have a congregation in front of him.
Yeah, they don't show the congregation, but he's also really, in that moment, he seems to really be processing the words for the first time in a long time.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. So you think that he's like, this is kind of the start of him finding his faith again?
Maybe. There's certainly a seed of that, I think. But I've always seen that as he's like, you know, he talks about this is my body. And then it's like it's really profound to him. Mm. Like he's really taking it all in a way that he hasn't in either a very long time or maybe even ever. And it's a small moment that I think is still really moving and telling about the character.
He goes to see Reagan again, and he tapes their conversation. She says, what a wonderful day for an exorcism.
What an excellent day for an exorcism. I love
that. He speaks Latin to her. She responds first in Latin, but then randomly in French. So this kind of speaks to when he told Chris that, you know, speaking a language that she had no prior knowledge of could be proof of possession. He approaches the bed. He's holding a small bottle and he tells her it's holy water. And he sprinkles it on her and she reacts violently. She's like, it burns, before speaking in absolute gibberish, or so we think. Mm-hmm. He consults with Chris after she gets off the phone with a friend. Now, how do you tell your friends about that situation? How much of this do you share with them?
How long is the time frame in this movie too? Because I think it's a fairly long one, but they don't really say.
I think it starts around Halloween because you see the kids in Halloween costumes.
True. Yeah.
But I don't know how much longer it is after that.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Yeah, it is a good question.
Something I think at some point they mentioned like a few weeks have passed or something.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming it's like over a month at least, but I don't know.
I mean, I would think so with all the, like, you know, Karis's mother goes into the hospital, right. Then she's released and goes home and she passes away and she's found a couple of days after she passes away. There's a lot of things that I feel like lend to it being at least, yeah, a month or maybe a little longer.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, the number of times I've seen this movie and never really thought about that, about the passage of time of it, you know. Mm-hmm.
I'm terrible for always thinking that if a scene happens at night and the next scene is happening in the day, I'm like, oh, that's the next day. That's just my little, right. Like, all mm-hmm. the time. In fact, at one point I wrote something in my notes and I'm like, the next day? I'm like, it's not the next day. The holy water was a trick, he tells Chris. The water was just tap water, which kind of lends credence to what the doctors had said earlier, that if she believes it, it will work. Mm. But if it's an actual demon, then it doesn't. And we do learn that it is an actual demon, so...
It could be lying. It could be faking.
Mm-hmm. Chris confides in him that Reagan killed Burke Dennings. And so I think this is kind of his impetus to be like, okay, now we really need to fix this because it's an extreme situation. So he takes his recordings to a language lab and he learns that the gibberish is just English in reverse. So she says, I am no one. She says Marin's name a couple of times. She says, Fear mm-hmm. the priest. And as he's listening to this, he gets a call from Sharon. Now, we actually don't know who Father Marin is yet because I don't think in the first scene he's not referred to by name, I don't believe.
I don't think so.
So Sharon doesn't want Chris to see what she's discovered. So she takes Karis into Reagan's room where they see the words, help me, rising on her stomach, like on her skin. Yeah. He takes this to the church. He's still not convinced, but he wants to perform the exorcism. The church, however, wants somebody more experienced to do it, but thinks that it may be useful for Karis to assist. So this is when Father Lancaster Marin comes back into the story. He is back in the country. He has experience with lengthy and difficult exorcisms, so he's chosen for the job. So it's funny because he has the title role, but Max von Sydow has less screen time than the rest of the main cast.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
He arrives at the McNeil household, and we get an extreme close-up of Reagan's face just as he arrives. And we get that iconic shot with him standing outside of the house. The lamp is shining on him, and he is like the light in the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
He enters the house. They're making their introductions, and we hear the demon scream from upstairs.
Marin! Yeah.
Father Marin wants to start right away. He doesn't need the details. Whereas, like, Karis really wants to tell him all of the details. He wants to give him the backstory. He's like, you need to know about, I think there are three personalities. Like, he still seems to think that it's a psychological issue. Mm-hmm. He wants to give him the backstory. But he's like, no, let's just do this. I want to get this. Let's get this taken care of.
There is only one, you know.
Yeah.
Seem to be three. There is only one.
No nonsense.
He is steadfast. But when he is praying with his rosary held in his hand and his hand is shaking,
mm-hmm.
that's one of my favorite images in the whole movie. Because here is this man that is physically frail, weak, and yet he is going to put himself up against this demon to mm-hmm. save this young girl. And like, it's so powerful. Next come the rules of the exorcism. So he's like, avoid conversations with the demon. The demon is a liar. He'll mix lies with the truth to attack them. Don't listen to him. He is the perfect counterpart to Karis. Before starting the exorcism, Father Marin asks Chris, does she have a middle name? So in the Middle Ages, Catholics used to give their children several names as they believed that that would hinder Satan from finding out the child's real name and controlling the child's soul. And I mean, names are always powerful in movies. So when you think about, like, I always think about the line in The Conjuring The Conjuring 2, when she's like, I know your name, demon. It gives me power over you. That's kind of what I always think of when I think of that. Karis and Marin enter the bedroom. It is showtime. The demon brings out its best profanity, but Marin just takes control and he's like, be silent. And there's more projectile vomiting. They start to pray.
The spit on his glasses part.
Yeah.
I love that. How he the demon just spits at him and he just kind of casually takes off his glasses and keeps going. He's completely unflappable for so much of this. Even though, like you said, he's this frail man who would be so broken and weakened by all this, you would think.
Mm-hmm. And he's the complete opposite of like Karis, right? When Karis gets spit on, he's disgusted and
grossed out and everything. Yeah.
So the bed starts to shake and the demon basically barks at them while Marin continues to pray. And he does not waver, not even when the bed levitates off the ground. He is just plowing forward. Whereas Karis is shook and he has to be reminded to respond. Like a couple of times, I think he's like, Father Marin has to say something to Damien, remind him.
Damien, the response, please, Damien. seen this once or twice, sorry.
I was going to say. And he is physically struggling as the demon is laughing at him. But he rebounds and says, I cast you out, unclean spirit.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the first time where you really see Marin kind of get sound desperate and passionate about this. You know, he's and, you know, they haven't even been doing it that long, but he's just like, come on.
I listened to a podcast a while ago about the making of The Exorcist. And I think it was that line. Is it right after that where there's a shot of the ceiling cracking?
Yeah.
So I guess they had like built six ceilings and they had done six takes and that like he was just playing it very calmly and that I cast you out and Friedkin had to pull him aside and be like, what is the matter? Like, why? Like, we need a little more here. Like, you're fighting a demon. And he was like, well, sometimes the most dramatic deliveries are said calmly. And he was like, yeah, no, we need something more. And they had run out of ceilings. They had to, like, build some more. And so I think, like, it's not in the same shot that we see the ceiling crack and him say that. And I think that's why.
Well, Sidow's reason was he just don't believe in the supernatural. Just don't believe in the devil. I cannot muster up the what you want from this. I can't remember exactly what he ended up saying to get that performance out of him. That's slipping my mind. I wish I had reviewed that because I think Friedkin goes into that pretty lengthy in – is it the Leap of Faith documentary that just came out? He really talks about that sequence for a while. And that, by the way, is very much worth watching. To it's anyone so who hasn't watched it yet, it's so good.
Yes, I need to,
so
need
good. To great insights into more than I thought I knew everything there was to know about this movie from Friedkin's autobiography, from, you know, the Fear of God documentary, all these things that I had seen over the years, the cursed films thing on Shudder, all that stuff. But that was just so much more stuff that I just didn't have any idea about. So really, really great documentary.
It is. It's fantastic. I think didn't he say something about like, do you need me to get Ingmar Bergman in here for you? Like,
right. He said, I'm going to fly him out for you. Yeah. It's like, oh no. Yeah. It's like, cause I will.
Yeah. I think whenever he said like, I'm not religious, Friedkin's like, you played Jesus. Like,
that's right. but he's like, but I played Jesus as a man.
Yes.
That's right. Speaking of the cursed films, series is also, it's a lot of fun. I don't believe in curses. However, it is still, it's very interesting to see the things that some of these movies went through.
And to see how some of the people sort of read these curses into the situations, you know, the coincidences, frankly, that occur on some of them, you know, like Ellen Burstyn talks about, you know, the nine deaths that were linked to The Exorcist. Yeah. And Max von Sydow's like, yeah, you know, we shot the thing for a year. People die. You know, I kind of like the different takes on all that stuff.
So as mentioned, the ceiling starts to crack, the door splinters, but Marin is on a roll. And this is where we get the famous 360-degree demon head spinning before she tells Karis that his mother will never forgive him that he left her to die. The straps begin to break as Reagan's eyes turn white and she levitates over the bed. The priests repeat, the power of Christ compels you, 14 times as they throw holy water on her, which actually causes physical wounds on her skin. So I play a game called Phasmophobia, and one of my favorite lines to shout at the ghost in the game is, the power of Christ compels you.
Well, I mean, that's one of those moments that, I mean, it's sort of endlessly parodied, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was done in Austin Powers movie, you know, where the chair won't stop. That the power of Christ compels you. I need an old priest and a young priest, you know.
She slowly lowers back down to the bed where Karis binds her again, but she sits up. He's kind of like crouched at the end of the bed. She sits up and hits him in the back and knocks him to the ground. The entire room shakes. Both priests are thrown to the ground and she kneels on the bed. And this scene where we see Pazuzu appear behind her and she's kind of mm-hmm. like reaching up and there's the blue light. It's heavily shadowed.
Oh, I love that shot.
Yeah, it's so good. And if you had any doubt that there was a demon involved, doubt no more. Marin suggests, you know what, let's rest before we start again. Earlier, one of the other priests that are talking about bringing Marin in mentions that Marin was involved in an exorcism that lasted for months. Like, this has lasted for 9 minutes.
Time dilation, I'm sure. It's probably, you know, hours or so.
True.
In real, but, you know.
The two priests then sit on the stairs outside of the room and Karis wants to know why this is happening to Reagan. And Marin says, it's to make us despair, to reject the possibility of God's love. And the contrast here between Marin, who is spiritually stronger but physically weaker than Karis, is striking. Marin has to take a break to take his pills, whereas Karis really needs a break to recover emotionally and mentally.
You know, it's funny. That's originally in the original cut of the film, there's no conversation. They just show them on the stairs for a moment and just sort of resting and taking a break, but they don't mm-hmm. say anything to each other. And that's one of the additions that I think is actually maybe strengthens the movie a bit, to have that a little tiny bit of conversation about the why. Mm-hmm. of it all mm-hmm. is striking, because as audiences, you know, I think that's part of, maybe that's the original cut, maybe leaves that more to the audience's own belief or own perceptions of things. Mm-hmm. Whereas this one really does, the recut version doesn't answer the questions, but sort of gives a little bit more of a philosophical, I guess, element to it all. As well, or a little bit to ponder there. So I actually, that's one of the additions that I do like quite a bit.
Yeah, I think it fits with like the whole, like with Karis's crisis of faith, right? It ties yeah. really well into that. And he needs to know why this would happen and why God would let this happen. And it kind of like gives him like a solid point to start from, I guess. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Karis has entered the bedroom while Marin is gone to take his pills. And he first sees a vision of his mother sitting on the bed.
That's so heartbreaking.
Oh, it's awful. Yeah. He says, Dimmy, why you do this to me? I'm afraid. And like, it's just, it's so sad.
Just this little woman sort of in that, bathed in that white light, that mm-hmm. bright white light. And she looks so tiny. And
yeah, like the bed, yeah. like she's dwarfed by that bed.
Yeah.
Karis is afraid that Reagan's heart is going to give out, but he's really struggling with the demon's imitation of his mother. So Marin comes in and he sends him out of the room, which is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. And he continues the exorcism. Downstairs, Chris asks Karis if it's over, if Reagan is going to die. This seems to give Karis some new resolve because he slowly heads back upstairs, just as his new friend, Lieutenant Kinderman, shows up. Karis enters the bedroom. He finds Father Marin slumped over the bed. And Reagan is just leaning against the bedpost, very casual. Like, she's just kind of hanging out. He attempts violent CPR on the priest.
Yeah, like the not yeah, chest compressions, violent. Like the just hitting pounding, him with the fist. Yeah. yeah.
But it's too late. Karis grabs Reagan. He wrestles her to the ground and punches her repeatedly before saying, take me, take me. So Reagan takes his medallion. His medallion is a St. Joseph medallion, and St. Joseph was the patron saint of people in doubt. Mm-hmm. So he regains his faith as he demonstrates his compassion and love of humanity as he sacrifices himself to save Reagan. And you can see his face change. You can see him fight as the demon takes control. He kind of goes to strangle Reagan, but then he throws himself out the window and falls down the stairs.
The stuntman did it twice.
Twice? Oh,
wow. Threw really? Himself down the stairs twice. There's like quarter-inch padding on the stone steps. Those are real stone steps, though. And he did it twice.
I did see that Georgetown students charged $5 for people to watch the scene being shot. Pretty brilliant. So Kinderman and Chris enter the room. Kinderman looks out the window to see Father Karras's body at the bottom of the stairs. Chris realizes that her daughter is back and they embrace each other. They're crying. And Kinderman seriously looks like he's like, what happened, as he's surveying the room?
Yeah.
I do kind of wonder what the aftermath of some of this is, like legally.
Oh, geez, yeah.
That's why they wrap it up before that happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't need to tie up those.
Father Dyer happens to be on site and he administers last rites to his friend, Father Karras. And this is actually a scene where Friedkin was not happy with Father Dyer's performance, William O'Malley's performance. And he said, "Do you trust me?" And O'Malley said, "Yes." And he got slapped across the face.
Yeah. So he punched him in the face. Yeah. So now this is where, I mean, I know you said Father Marin is the title character of The Exorcist, but I've always wondered, is it Father Marin? Is it Father Karras, or is it Father Dyer that's the Exorcist?
I thought about Father Karras being the Exorcist, but Father Dyer, that's intriguing.
Because Father Dyer administers the last rites to, which would effectively have to exorcise the demon out of him, right?
Right.
At the end of the film. So it's one of those things. It's one of those things. Does it ultimately really matter? But it's an interesting just sort of thought to bring in, you know, who is the exorcist? Is it, which one of those three is really the exorcist? And so, I don't know. I find that to just be sort of a fun little discussion to have with myself because no one else talks about it with me. But
oh, now I'm like really thinking about that. I've never thought of that. It could be. You're right. Yeah. Like saying the last rites, like would. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Austin?
I mean, that's really interesting. I wouldn't have ever thought of that.
Well, I food for thought, I guess.
You solved it.
That's to put out there for everyone.
The ordeal is over. Chris and Reagan are not sticking around. It's time to move out. But not before one last conversation with Father Dyer, possibly the exorcist. She tells him that Reagan doesn't remember any of it, which is a good thing. Thank goodness. But she does seem to have some recollection, maybe very deep inside, because when she sees that he's a priest, when she sees his collar, she gives him a kiss on the cheek, like very suddenly. Like she sees it. There's a very like deliberate close-up on the little white part of the collar, and then she leans in for a little quick kiss on the cheek.
I love the look on her face right after that, though, because she's kind of like, why did I do that? It's subtle and really momentary, but it's for a child performance like that. It's a beautiful touch. So one, well done.
Chris gives Father Dyer the St. Joseph medallion before he hands it back to her. So it seems like Chris is open to faith now by accepting this medallion. Father Dyer looks down the stairs before turning away, and he's so sad.
Movie ends. That's where the movie ends.
So this is the part that you don't like?
That's the original cut. That's where the original cut ends, with him looking down the steps and the tubular bells start to play and it cuts to black. I don't like the ending with Kinderman. I just think it's unnecessary. It's kind of hokey and silly, and it just doesn't work for me. I know that that is the way Friedkin felt for a long time, too. Since Blatty has passed, he has changed his mind, and he's come to prefer the re-release cut, or at least says he does in public. And I'm like, great. That's I'm glad. But for me, I just don't like that last little tag. I don't, it just doesn't work for me.
I agree with you that it is a little hokey. So he runs into Lieutenant Kinderman. He says Regan's fine. He invites him to the movies. Then they kind of walk across the street with this kind of new burgeoning friendship. But I think you're right. It kind of takes away from the gravity of the end and adds this little, I think hokey is the perfect word for it. You described it as hokey, and I think it is a little hokey.
So, I mean, you don't have to agree with me or anything. You can definitely, you know, I know that there got to be people who prefer that ending, and I'm great with that. It's just my personal opinion, but I'd love to hear, you know, dissenting if there are. So anyway, that's what I just wanted to throw that in.
I don't think I've seen the original cut, so that's the only ending that I've seen, but... Yeah, but yeah, it is a little hokey, kind of turns into like a little buddy, new buddies, I guess. But like, yeah, kind of unnecessary. I don't mind it. I like a good happy ending. So I'm kind of okay with it, but I can see it's definitely not
necessary. I think the original ending is more ambiguous than either happy or sad. Mm. It just leaves me with a more powerful feeling than the extended ending, because Dyer is just thinking about his friend, and you know, Blatty was like, I just don't want people to think the devil won, and Friedkin says, I don't know how you can think that. You know, I love the interview where they have the two of them together talking about that, and and because they're really just kind of at each other about it, you know, because one definitely prefers the longer cut, one of them definitely prefers the other cut, and it's the ending is the one that's the difference, that I the biggest difference between the two, the one that means, that makes the most difference. And for me, it just leaves the movie on a completely different tone than that original cut, which I think just strikes the perfect tone for me.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Describing it, just hearing you describe it, I can definitely see that I feel like maybe that the original ending would be the one that I would prefer. As much as I do like I said, I do like a happy ending, but in terms of like powerful and emotional resonance, yeah.
Well, all right.
Well, that's the movie. What stood out for you? What makes this a great horror movie? And some people have argued that it's not a horror movie, which is not an argument that I want to have because I hate that argument. But
about any movie. I don't know how you can say it's not. It's pretty well established that it's a demon, you know, that there's a supernatural element. I mean, not every horror movie includes supernatural elements, of course, but this one does, and there happens to be horrifying elements connected to that supernatural element. So how is it not a horror movie? You know?
Yeah. It's funny because one of the things that I thought of for things that stood out to me was how much of the movie, I don't want to say isn't a horror movie, but how much of the movie doesn't have what you think of as horror necessarily. It's listed on Amazon as a thriller. Which surprised me. But yeah, but there's a lot of, like, there's a drama. Like, Father Karras's storyline is so compelling, and it's horrific in its own way, and there's no supernatural elements to that part. So I do forget, like, how much of the movie isn't just, like, the scary scenes that I remember seeing as a kid, you know? Which makes it, like, all the more compelling and all the more interesting to me. And the other thing that really stood out to me was how much I love Chris and how just strong of a character she is. She also has to deal with a lot of men condescending to her. Yeah. And I just love the way that, like, she sticks to her guts, or to her gut. She, you know, she sticks up for her daughter. She advocates for her daughter, pushes for what she believes is needed. And I mean, just, it's just such a great movie. It's so watchable.
I think what works for me is how you, and Friedkin says this a lot, you know, you take out of The Exorcist what you put into it, what you bring to it. So you can see it in multiple ways. You can see it as a demon for so much of the movie or not. You know, like you said, Austin, there's so much of it that is not supernatural, that is the horrifying elements of just like the medical testing and stuff. Those are the scenes that, like I said, disturb me the most. You can see it as a dark story. You can see it as a story of hope. You can see it all sorts of different ways. And there are just so many interpretations and methods of watching the movie. And there are so many different ways to watch it, you know, just at different times of life or different phases of faith or not faith, you know, that are just really powerful and effective years and years and years later.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I like about it is, so I saw it for the first time when I was in my 20s, and what I reacted to the most was the possession story. But then as I got older and watched it more and more, so like I've gone through like different journeys with it, right? So like there's the, I'm not a parent, but I have nieces and nephews. And so I think about, you know, seeing them being vulnerable and not knowing what, like if that were them and not knowing what's going on with them and what would I do or what would my brothers do to get answers for their child and like how horrifying that would be. And then there's the, like the crisis of faith and seeing like Karis and his story arc and comparing him to Marin, who maybe you don't know, Marin could have had a crisis of faith when he was younger. In fact, I think he's in the prequel. Is he not?
Yeah.
I haven't seen the prequel.
He's in, I've seen Dominion. I haven't actually seen the official release. The beginning. That's the only one I haven't seen.
And is there ever any inkling, like any hint that he's had a crisis of faith, or is he always like steadfast?
Well, I mean, it's a Paul Schrader movie, so yeah. Dominion is a Paul Schrader movie, so it's that seems to be sort of the thrust of that movie. It's been quite a long time since I've seen it, to be honest, but there's more of that in it, or I would have. As I recall, there is more of that in it with Father Marin.
So speaking of the other Exorcist movies and the TV show, any thoughts on any of those? Are you have you seen them? Are you a fan?
Exorcist 3 is
so good.
A near masterpiece.
I haven't seen it yet. I've been trying to work up the courage to. Like, it took me 20 years to get through this movie, so.
I would call The Exorcist 3 a sort of fractured masterpiece. Because the film that we have is, it's got its flaws. The sort of reassembled cut of the original, what Blatty originally wanted before the studio interfered is available through Shout Factory. It's not very good quality. But, you know, it exists. And so you can kind of at least get a sense of it. But it's the book is terrific, too. But I've always been a fan of The Exorcist 3, even when it was even before it was sort of reevaluated, you know.
It kind of had a renaissance.
Yeah, it did. Yep. It did. And as so many movies do, it's sort of like, you know, wait 10 years. You know, people like it in 10 years. So... as seems to be the case, like Scream 4, for some people, I actually am a huge fan of Scream 4, and there are my experience with I wrote an article about it recently, and it was published, and there are some people who are definitely not, and I heard from all of them. but anyway, but that is sort of the case, you know, where they're, the fans will sort of come up, will bubble up and find their way. Well, the thing is, The Exorcist 3 is just a damn good movie and always was, even with its sort of the ending that was sort of messed with by it's a kind of hard movie to get your hands around. There are things about it that are a little bit deeper, a little bit less straightforward, a little bit more confusing, a little bit more philosophical and theological about it. And it's all about struggling with faith. I mean, that's entirely what the movie's about, which is what Blatty was interested in, you know? You know, he was a Jesuit. He was interested in matters of faith and matters of doubt and was really good at writing those kinds of stories. And so I think The Exorcist 3 is terrific. The Exorcist 2, I'm not a fan. I know that it has its defenders, but I just can't do it. Like I said, I haven't seen The Exorcist Beginning. Dominion, I recall being good, but it's been so long. I only vaguely remember it. I liked the television show quite a bit. That first season, same. I thought was particularly strong. And it was sort of a true sequel to this film. Mm-hmm. Whereas Exorcist 3 is a little bit more tangential. It's about Kinderman and Dyer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I have the momentum now.
It does have one of the best jump scares in all of horror.
I know of it. I'm pretty sure I've seen the jump scare before.
For me, there's only one flaw in that entire scene. I think they should have... There's one insert shot that they put into it at one point, and I wish they had just kept the thing full long shot the whole time.
Fair enough.
Because it's just, she's just going about her business, then all of a sudden, you know, that kind of thing. So, that's a great jump scare. And it's been sort of parodied. It was brought into the new Black Christmas movie.
Oh, it was.
A little nod to it. That was pretty clever.
Oh, that's a movie that I hope people revisit in 10 years and are like, that is actually a really good movie.
I think they will, honestly. Yeah. I thought it was good. I know some people loved it more than I did, but I thought it was better than the haters were saying, for sure.
Yeah. Austin, have you seen the TV show?
No, I've been tempted. So if you guys say it's good, maybe I'll check it out.
It is. The first season is really good. The second season, I think, loses a little bit of what makes the first season good, but it's still, the two priest characters are mm-hmm. quite riveting.
I love Gina Davis, so I feel like I need to watch it.
Yeah. I think the second season, I think it just sort of lost a little momentum in the middle, which was too bad. I think they didn't know how to carry the story over a full season. However many episodes they did. If it had maybe been a shorter one, just like 10 episodes
or
6 episodes, it would have been perfect and probably would have been picked up for a third. But it was just maybe a little bit saggy in a couple of places that made it a little harder sell at some point.
All right. Anything else that stood out for you that you want to talk about? I feel like we've talked about a lot. We've talked about the music and lighting and...
I mean, the practical effects are definitely just incredible. I think that's part of what makes it just so easy to watch now. Like, it ages. I always feel like practical effects make movies age better and always is going to look better. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, than CGI. And it's just so good.
Yeah. Shout out to the great Dick Smith for his work on this movie, because it's just incredible. I know I mentioned him briefly, but you know, the spinning head, all of the things that we think of as iconic, you know, the figuring out how to make the pea soup shoot out of someone's mouth, you know, that was all him. And he was kind of a one-man show. I mean, he really did this stuff on his own, and just a genius of what he did. And he worked on, you know, The Godfather and Amadeus and, and Taxi Driver and all these things as well. And like I already mentioned, Altered States and Scanners too.
Yeah.
So just phenomenal work that he did. I just adore his work.
So body count, we had 4 deaths in the movie. So we had Karis's mom, we had Burke Dennings, Father Marin, and Father Karis.
It's funny. I never think about the body count in this movie.
No.
Because you see 2 of those, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how many scaredy cat screams would you give it on a scale of 1 through 5? It is strictly how much you love the movie, not necessarily how scary it is.
For me, it's 5. For me, it's 5. There's no question. This is a 5 out of 5 for me.
Yeah. I think I'm going to say 5 as well. Like I said, like, it has such a big impact. Such a big impact, like more than any other movie I can think of, really, to be like that lasting impression that it's had on me. And like, I'm so glad that when I finally did work up the nerve to sit through it, it was better than I expected to be. It was still scary, but I was so invested in it.
Yeah, I would also give it a 5. I think it's like a near perfect movie, and that makes this our first unanimous 5 out of 5.
Wow. Rating.
Wow. Yeah. Really?
In 25 episodes, I think. Yeah. So that's pretty impressive. Excellent. All right. So thank you for joining us today and talking about The Exorcist, one of my personal favorite horror movies. So why don't you tell us where we can find you? Tell us a little more about where we can find your podcasts and where we can find you on social media.
Sure. Yeah, you can. I'm on Twitter at Austin91. Right now, it's a lot of rage tweeting about our current situation. But I'm also, on the podcast, I Hate Your Taste in Movies. And you can find that anywhere you listen to podcasts. And we're on Twitter at I Hate Your Taste.
Great. And I'm at Brian D. Kuiper on Twitter. That's K-E-I-P-E-R for the non-German speaking folk, spelling folk. I wish I had kept a different handle, but for whatever reason, I went with my name. But, anyway, it is what it is. Can't change it now. And you can find our podcast, Movies for Life. You can find it, again, in iTunes, wherever you find podcasts, we're there. And you can find the podcast at Movie Life Pod on Twitter as well.
Excellent. I highly recommend that you listen to both podcasts. They're both fantastic. Probably two of my favorite podcasts that I listen to. So I really appreciate you guys coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for joining us today. You can catch us on Twitter at @CatScaredy and on Instagram at @ScaredyCats the podcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts, and don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.